From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Our country slaps us in the face and orders us don't ask and orders us don't tell. Well, I am telling you that the era and the time for asking is over. I am not asking anymore. I am telling. I am telling. I am telling. Will you tell with me?
West Point graduate and Iraq War veteran Lieutenant Dan Choi. He's facing discharge for the military for revealing he's gay. He was among tens of thousands who marched in Washington, D.C. Sunday for gay rights. He'll join us today to tell his story. And we'll be joined by attorney and longtime gay rights activist Irva Shivad. Then, Smile or Die, The Bright Side of Cancer. Barbara Ehrenreich takes a look at the dark roots of American optimism. Her new book is called Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate Finance Committee is expected to vote today on its version of health care reform legislation. Last month, the Democratic-controlled panel rejected amendments to include a public insurance option. But the insurance industry is still attacking the measure, claiming it doesn't do enough to force younger, healthy Americans into purchasing insurance. The industry wants harsher mandates so that Americans in poorer health don't account for the bulk of its new customers. On Monday, the White House and leading Democrats denounced an insurance industry study warning that the Senate finance measure would lead to increased costs for average families. Some have interpreted the study as a threat to raise costs rather than as an unbiased warning. Democratic Senator John Rockefeller of West Virginia said, quote, "Health insurance companies have been laughing all the way to the bank for generations while people suffer. The industry stands today as the greatest impediment to real health care reform," he said. The Washington Post is reporting the size of the Obama administration's troop increase in Afghanistan is greater than previously disclosed. The White House is sending an additional 13,000 troops on top of the 21,000 announced earlier this year. Most of the troops are said to play a support role with positions including engineers, medical personnel, intelligence experts, and military police. The buildup has left the U.S. with more troops in Iraq and Afghanistan than during the height of the Bush administration's troop surge in Iraq. In other news from Afghanistan, a member of a U.N.-backed election panel has resigned in protest of alleged foreign dominance of the panel's activities. Mulavi Mustafa Barakzai was one of only two Afghans on the Electoral Complaints Commission, which is responsible for certifying the vote. Barakzai says the commission's foreign members have been making all the decisions and ignoring local voices. The panel's expected to decide this week how many votes to disqualify amidst allegations of widespread fraud. In Honduras, talks between the coup regime and representatives of the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, continue today. Zelaya has imposed a Thursday deadline for a new agreement. Both sides have reportedly agreed to 5 of an 8-point Organization of American States proposal, but the coup regime continues to reject the basic demand of Zelaya's restoration. On Monday, Zelaya's foreign minister, Patricia Rodas, warned the situation on the ground is worsening by the day.
La situación que está ocurriendo ahora mismo en Honduras, que lejos de alivianar la situación se va agravando cada día más.
The situation right now in Honduras, far from improving, is becoming worse each day. Even in the midst of a dialogue process which began last week under the auspices of the Organization of American States and is now in hiatus due to the fact that the regime is placing serious obstacles to the process of the restitution of the president.
Serios obstáculos al proceso de la restitución.
Rodas also addressed reports of a growing number of foreign paramilitaries inside Honduras hired by the coup regime and wealthy landowners.
El uso de paramilitares que provienen de diversas nacionalidades.
The use of paramilitary forces of different nationalities has been said to be for the benefit of landowners.
Para proteger sus propiedades dada la escalada de violencia.
To protect their properties due to the escalation in violence.
Pretextos también tradicionales para justificar la presencia de mercenarios.
We believe that those are the traditional excuses used to justify the presence of mercenaries to do the dirty job that the armed forces refuse to do.
Dentro de los cuerpos armados.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's in Moscow today for talks with the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. The Russian newspaper Kommersant is reporting the U.S. has privately agreed to stop publicly criticizing Russia's human rights record in return for Russian cooperation on confronting Iran and so-called missile defense. In Israel and the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to prevent any international prosecutions of Israelis for the assault on the Gaza Strip. Speaking before the Israeli parliament, Netanyahu said a recent UN inquiry accusing Israel of war crimes, quote, encourages terror and endangers the peace. Netanyahu also renewed Israeli demands that Palestinians explicitly recognize Israel as a Jewish state rather than just grant it normal recognition.
I call again to our Palestinian neighbors, say yes to a Jewish state. I know this recognition is not easy for the Palestinian leadership. I know it is a step that requires courage. I call on the heads of the Palestinian Authority to tell their people the truth, that without recognition of Israel as the state of the Jewish people, we cannot achieve peace.
The UN Security Council is expected to take up the UN report on the Gaza assault tomorrow. In China, six people have been sentenced to death for their alleged roles in the clashes between the local Han Chinese and the Uyghur residents earlier this year. All the defendants appear to be Uyghurs. At least 150 people were killed and over 1,000 injured in what was described as the bloodiest ethnic violence to hit China in decades. A U.S. academic has become the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics. Eleanor Ostrom of the University of Indiana was named co-winner of the prize Monday for her research into how communities can self-organize without state or corporate management.
I'm not denigrating that that officials can do something very positive. But what we have ignored is what citizens can do and the importance of real involvement of the people involved as opposed to just having somebody in Washington or at far, far distant make a rule. How does that get all the way down to management of forests, fisheries, irrigation systems, etc.? So we have to look ground up.
Ostrom also celebrated her distinction as the first woman to win the Nobel Economics Prize.
We're entering a new, we've already entered a new era, and we recognize that women have the capabilities of doing great scientific work. And yes, I appreciate that this is an honor to be the first woman, but I won't be the last.
Military censors at Guantanamo have banned a book by the MIT professor and leading political analyst Noam Chomsky from the prison library. Published in 2007, Interventions compiles a series of Chomsky's columns. The Pentagon has refused to explain why the book has been barred. Chomsky commented, quote, "This happens sometimes in totalitarian regimes." The three surviving children of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. have reached a private settlement in a dispute over his estate. Dexter King's two siblings had filed a suit accusing him of improperly handling the corporation that manages their father's legacy. The deal avoids a public jury trial that would have likely revealed extensive personal and financial details about the King estate. And the 2009 Right Livelihood Awards have been announced with four recipients. The Canadian scientist David Suzuki will receive the honorary award for his lifelong environmental advocacy. The other honorees are Congo activist René Ngongo, who has fought for preserving the Congo's rainforests, New Zealand anti-nuclear activist Alan Ware, and Catherine Hamlin, an Australian doctor who's treated African women, particularly in Ethiopia, suffering from childbirth injuries for over 50 years. The Right Livelihood Awards are awarded annually and are widely known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. They'll be awarded in the Swedish Parliament on December 4th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkaddous.
And welcome, everyone. We begin today with a look at what the Obama administration has done to promote equal rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in this country. On the eve of Sunday's National Equality March for Gay Rights in Washington, D.C., President Obama once again pledged to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which bars openly gay men and lesbians from serving in the military. Obama reiterated his promise Saturday in a speech before the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest gay political organization.
We are moving ahead on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We should not be punishing patriotic Americans who have stepped forward to serve this country. We should be celebrating their willingness to show such courage and selflessness on behalf of their fellow citizens, especially when we're fighting two wars. We cannot afford to cut from our ranks people with the critical skills we need to fight any more than we can afford for our military's integrity to force those willing to do so into careers encumbered and compromised by having to live a lie. So I'm working with the Pentagon, its leadership, and the members of the House and Senate on ending this policy. Legislation has been introduced in the House to make this happen. I will end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's my commitment to you.
But many queer activists were frustrated with Obama for not following through on previous vows to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In his latest comments, he did not offer any new timetable for its repeal. A crowd of some 75 protesters outside the dinner accused the president of, quote, all talk and no action. They urged him to repeal both Don't Ask, Don't Tell, as well as the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. While tens of thousands took to the streets the following day to continue the nationwide fight for equal protection for LGBT people in all matters governed by civil law, it's been described as the largest demonstration for gay rights in the nation's capital in over a decade. Among those who spoke was Lieutenant Dan Choi, a West Point graduate and Iraq War veteran. He's facing discharge under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy for revealing in March that he's gay.
Now, I know that there are many things that are worth fighting for, and I've fought for many of them. And I will tell you that some of those are very, very expensive. But of all those things that are worth fighting for, love is worth fighting for. Love is worth it. Love is worth it. Some of us have come from very far places to be here today. You've sacrificed a lot, but love is worth it. Some of us have just come out of the closet this year. Some of us are still in the closet, but I want to tell you that love is worth it. We've sacrificed so much. Some of us have been rejected by our families and our communities and our churches and our workplaces, but I will tell you that love is worth it. And many of us have been discharged from the service because we told the truth. But I know that love is worth it. We love our country, even when our country refuses to acknowledge our love. But we continue to defend it and we continue to protect it because love is worth it. Love is worth it. If you believe it, say it with me. Love is worth it. Love is worth it. Love is worth it. Love is worth it. Like so many others, I joined the military because my country beckoned me. Ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. But when we're telling the truth about our love, our country slaps us in the face and orders us, don't ask. And orders us, don't tell. Well, I am telling you that the era and the time for asking is over. I am not asking anymore. I am telling. I am telling. I am telling. Will you tell with me? Asking is over. We will tell. Because in the face of injustice and the face of discrimination, patience is not a plan. In the face of discrimination, silence is not a strategy. My plan today and my plan tomorrow and my plan forever is to tell, and we will tell, we will tell, we will tell.
Lieutenant Dan Choi speaking Sunday. He joins us now from Washington, D.C., founder of Nights Out, a group of LGBT graduates of West Point. And joining us here in our Firehouse studio is attorney and longtime gay rights activist Urvashi Vaid. She also spoke at the Gay Rights March. She's currently executive director of the Arcus Foundation, formerly executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, author of Virtual Equality, the Mainstreaming of Gay and Lesbian Liberation. In April of this year, she was named one of Out Magazine's 50 Most Influential Men and Women in America. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Lieutenant Dan Choi, why don't you start off by telling us your story? Yes, we see you addressing thousands of people in Washington, but talk about where you grew up and how you came to the point you are today.
Amy, I think it's so important, and thank you so much for having me on. People see some of those things that we say in front of large crowds, but they don't realize some of the personal sacrifices that get us to where we are. I'm originally from Orange County, California. My parents are immigrants from Korea. They've only been here about 40 years. My dad is a Southern Baptist minister, and my mom is a nurse in the maternity ward at our local hospital. That means she loves babies. That means she would love more than anything that I have a dozen Korean grandbabies for her. But, you know, when I came out of the closet to them just earlier on this year, a lot of people told me that I shouldn't do that. A lot of people told me, why don't you just stay silent? Why don't you just be quiet and lie about it? Well, when I came back from Iraq, I finally understood what love was when I started a relationship, my very first one. And I didn't want to lie about that anymore. I didn't feel that if I respected my parents and I respect and love them, that that kind of a relationship should be based on anything other than integrity and full disclosure. They should be a part of it. So I told my mom, she said, you know, I love you, but gay doesn't exist. And my dad was, you know, also very skeptical. He didn't understand it. So then I realized I'd only told them, and they've only known about 28 seconds, while I've known about 28 years. So I thought that it was going to take decades or maybe even multiple decades for them to understand, much less accept anything. But about four days ago, right as I was landing here in D.C. in preparation for this march, I had a phone call with my dad. And he said that he loves me and that he accepts me as his gay son. That's something I never would have expected. And it's been a crazy journey ever since we started this group of West Point graduates who are LGBT, as well as our supporters. We've been on TV telling the message that don't ask, don't tell erodes this nation as far as our values, as far as integrity. I've been on Korean Christian conservative radio stations and TV broadcasts, and my dad has seen all of that, and it's just absolutely amazing. And I look back on those people that say, you know, you should have just waited until maybe a more convenient time to tell him, or maybe you should just waited till he died in order to live your life truthfully. And I look at them now and I say, I wonder what you're saying. If I would have waited for that long, for a right time, would my parents they be accepting at this moment? I would tell everybody else, now is not the time to wait. If you really respect these things in our country, in your lives, if you respect your parents, if you respect the people you work with, don't wait. Push, tell them, be truthful because you love them.
Well, Lieutenant Dan Choi, when we come back from break, we'll find out how the military has dealt with you, and we'll also speak with Urvashi Vaid about the movement today, where it's going, about President Obama and his stance. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub.
Gil Scott Heron, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkaddous. Our guests are Lieutenant Dan Choi. He's speaking to us from Washington, D.C., West Point graduate, Iraq War vet, facing discharge under the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, founder of Nights Out, a group of LGBT graduates of West Point, and Urvashi Vaid, attorney and longtime gay rights activist. She's executive director of the Arcus Foundation and the former executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Sheree?
Lieutenant Dan Choi, you first came out publicly on the Rachel Maddow Show earlier this year in March. You then wrote a letter to President Obama and members of Congress asking that you not be fired. Can you describe what you wrote about in that letter and what's happened since then?
My letter was based on the very first lessons that I learned at the military academy at West Point about 10 years ago. Before we learned anything about the military, before we learned how to stand at attention or salute or march in step, we learned the honor code. The honor code that says a cadet will not lie or tolerate those who lie. It's simple. It doesn't say that that's just relevant to straight cadets or straight soldiers. Whereas under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gay soldiers are forced to lie. It's an order to them that they deceive based on who they love, those things that support them going on. So I wanted to send a message to President Obama that our military, and not only our military, but our society's values are based on integrity first. There are a lot of things on everybody's priority lists and their agendas and their plates, as people might call it. But I think when you look at what our nation is founded on, when you look at what our communities and our fabric is made out of, you have to look at our values. Do you believe in lying? And when are you going to restore integrity to all of our soldiers? And when are you going to support them in doing that? So that was essentially what I said. Now you look at a couple of the things that are going on. Since then, there's been a debate on whether we should send more troops to Afghanistan. I was just marching out here 2 days ago with thousands upon thousands of college-age Americans. They would gladly join their ROTC programs. In a heartbeat, they would join. And they're educated. They have skills for reconstruction or engineering or the medical professions or translating. Myself, I am an Arabic linguist. That was my degree from West Point. I also have a degree in environmental engineering. When I was in Iraq, I was helping with the reconstruction. I think that's critical in any kind of a counterinsurgency effort. But here you have a ban on honesty in the military, at least for our gay and lesbian service members, and you've kicked out 13,000 service members because they're truthful about who they are. The problem is not just that we 13,000 are the victims. There's 13,000 units out there. There's 13,000 teams that are now without the skills that those soldiers, those service members can provide. So when you're talking about sending troops to Afghanistan, you're now discounting these groups of people that are willing, capable, strong, and wanting to serve, but they just don't want to sacrifice their integrity in order to do it. And I think the lesson here is, whatever you do, whether you send troops or not, whatever number you send, the most important thing is that you send a message to the rest of the world that if we're over there in other countries telling anybody about democracy or equality or a pluralistic society or respecting all different groups and tribes and political affiliations, we should do the same at home. And we shouldn't sacrifice our values and pit groups against each other and strip rights away from other people and force soldiers and service members to lie while we're doing something of preaching to other countries.
And so the military did send you a letter. You're facing discharge. Where does that stand right now?
Technically, I am still in the military, so I am a serving officer. I am a lieutenant in the Army National Guard. I'm an infantry officer. And right now, the recommendation as of June 28th was to discharge me. Regardless of my skill as an Arabic interpreter or as a West Point graduate or a combat veteran, I even gave a good portion of my testimony before the Board of Officers in Arabic. And the officers asked me afterwards, Lieutenant, can you translate that? Because there was nobody in the entire building that can translate that Arabic into English so that they could understand it. And that's part of the devastation of what Don't Ask, Don't Tell is, not only to the service member, but to the entire military. We're being stripped of these capabilities. So I will gladly stay in the military. I will gladly serve. And if this law gets repealed and I happen to be discharged by then, I will be the first person in that recruiting station, because whether we're going to war or whether we are helping with humanitarian reconstruction and rehabilitation, or helping out with the operations in Katrina, or putting out fires all throughout our nation, there are people that are willing to step up and be part of the team. And you're stripping away that ability and that responsibility from those people because they refuse to sacrifice their integrity, and you're forcing them to lie.
And Lieutenant Dan Choi, how will the discharge affect retirement benefits, affect your West Point scholarship?
At this point, they have said that I can get an honorable discharge, general discharge, or an other than honorable discharge. I know some people don't understand all the differences and nuances, but many people have gotten other than honorable discharges, and that simply means that you get no benefits that you've earned. You will be stripped of your VA, that's Veterans Affairs, home loan benefits, your Montgomery GI, that's your education scholarship benefits, and even your medical benefits. If I get an other than honorable discharge, and I'm 50% disabled, I have respiratory illnesses and fractures and all these things that have been incurred through my service, I would lose the very benefit of going into a hospital, a VA hospital. I wouldn't be able to get medical treatment. So a lot of things are on the line, and it's even worse for a lot of people. You hear about people like my classmate, Anthony Woods, who graduated from Harvard after his two tours in Iraq, and he had to pay back over $30,000 in his tuition. A West Point education is now estimated to be worth about $500,000. And so I would have to pay back a portion of that. Depends on the kind of discharge that you get, but I want to tell you that I've continued to stay in contact with my Iraqi friends, and I got a message from an Iraqi doctor. We helped to rebuild his hospital while I was there, and he's in South Baghdad right now. And he's seen some of the internet, YouTube, and CNN interviews and other appearances, and he said, "Brother, I know that you're gay, but you're still my brother, and you're my friend. And if your country that sent you to my country, if America that sent you to Iraq will discharge you such that you can't get medical benefits, you can come to my hospital any day. You can come in and I will give you treatment. In South Baghdad, you can come, because it's my duty to pay you back somehow for the sacrifices that you've made. It would be my honor." So I hope that our country can learn from that Iraqi doctor.
Lieutenant Dan Choi is an Iraq War veteran. He's facing discharge from the military under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He's also founder of Nights Out, a group of LGBT graduates of West Point. We're also joined in the Firehouse studio by Urvashi Vaj. She's an attorney and longtime gay rights activist, executive director of the Arcus Foundation. Urvashi, the significance of this protest on Sunday and where you see the gay rights movement right now.
The protest on Sunday was very large. There were over 200,000 people who marched. And in many ways, it was a surprise to some of the more established organizations because they hadn't, in fact, called for it. This was called for by a grassroots younger generation. And I think the significance is threefold. First, it's a generational shift in the LGBT movement. There is a new wave of activism coming up, and it's gay and straight. That's the second, I think, big change. In my many years of involvement in the LGBT movement, it's been primarily LGBT people who have been out there on the streets. In this rally in March, there were really quite large numbers of non-gay families, friends, allies. They had signs. That's how I could identify. And people with signs like an interracial couple who were standing there, they must have been in their early 30s, white man, African-American woman, with a sign that said, our marriage was once illegal, too. And other people with signs saying they were supporting their friends and family members. I think the third difference is, or the third shift that's happening in the LGBT movement, is that it's much more of a multi-issue agenda that is being carried by the people who are marching. Certainly the focus of the march was equality, equal rights across the country, in every state and at the national level. And it was wonderful to have a very concise and clear focus. But as people spoke at the rally, you could hear it in the way they described equality, that they see it as linked to racial justice. They see it as integral to the concept of social justice. And I think that's really wonderful that it's a progressive movement.
So, Urvashi, talk about the gay and lesbian establishment organizations. I mean, you were once head of one.
Yes.
And where they stand with President Obama and the pressure that Obama is under right now and the kind of grassroots insurgency that's risen up.
You know, I think that I ran the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and I have a lot of affection and empathy for what it takes to build an LGBT movement and an infrastructure. I've been part of building that infrastructure from the local, state, national, and now international level. And we need those organizations. Without them doing the day-in, day-out work of training, organizing, education, advocacy, you wouldn't have the conditions for progress. You wouldn't have the litigation that we have won in the courts. At the same time, what happens in almost every social movement is that organizational development can actually stifle grassroots innovation and activism. We saw that in the women's movement. I think we've seen that in the women's movement. I think that the existence of national organizations and the disappearance of a grassroots activist movement has hurt women's liberation. I think we've seen that in the civil rights movement, where you have an aging leadership in the institutional infrastructure and younger people of color are doing other things. They're in the immigrant rights community. They're in the economic justice movement. So I think what was heartening to me about this was that there is a new wave of energy that will come in to the LGBT movement and revitalize those organizations. I think that the other thing I wanted to observe is that, you know, Congressman Frank's remarks got a lot of attention this weekend and this week, where he was very dismissive of the grassroots protests and the energy. And he said the only thing that this was going to leave an impression on was the grass or something like that in Washington. And it was a very, you know, typical, beautifully stated Barney comment, you know, sarcastic and brilliant. But it misses the point that you must have outside pressure in order for the lobbying to succeed. Power yields nothing without a demand. And you have to have people pressing people like Barney in order for him to be able to walk in and say, hey, do you want to deal with me or do you want to deal with them? It gives people like who are working the inside game a lot more credibility. And I think he didn't do the movement a good service by those comments.
But your thoughts on President Obama, his election was hailed by gay advocates around the country. He, on Saturday, did not give any new timeline for appealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where he could issue an executive order. I mean, at the very beginning of his taking office, at his inauguration, he selected Rick Warren, which angered many gay advocates, sure, a leading opponent of same-sex marriage. Where do you see his administration right now on this? And also the fact that it was under a Democratic administration that DOMA was passed, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was passed. Where do you see it happening in Congress and at the White House level?
That's a great question, and I think that, you know, I might be a little more moderate about my critiques of President Obama than some of the people who were at the march, who were quite unimpressed with the speech. I thought it was a really impressive statement of commitment. I thought it was quite unequivocal in its support for LGBT human rights. I think there are three or four areas in which I think he needs to go farther. One is, I don't understand how you can support all the rights and responsibilities of marriage, but then not the term marriage or the equal status of marriage. And marriage equality is a sort of a non-negotiable issue for the gay movement, because we believe we are morally equal. We believe we are politically equal, and we should be morally equal in every aspect of life. So I think he didn't go far enough there. I think on the military, I don't understand the obstacle there either. He has been committed to it. There's tremendous support in the country for it, and he needs to just use his political capital. So I agree that there are some critiques that we can be that can be made. But unlike Bill Clinton, Barack Obama's endorsement of LGBT rights was quite deep, and it's true. Bill Clinton gave us DOMA. Bill Clinton gave us Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And hopefully the Obama administration will not give us terrible policies that we'll have to undo for the next 30 years. My critique and my beef is much more with Congress. The Democratic-controlled Congress, and we have absolutely no traction. Or, you know, a hate crimes bill passes and we're supposed to be excited about that. Well, this is sort of basic. People should not be beaten up because of who they are. And if it's a big thing to celebrate that. I think that's sad. I think the leadership of the Democratic Party has been on the record in support of gay rights, but they have not expended their political capital to push for gay rights. And that has got to change. So to me, the focus has to be those 435 congressional districts. The focus has to be, and this is what I called for at the march, was that people go home and take seriously what the polls are telling us, that there is a new electoral majority that we are part of. It is a majority of progressive whites, black, brown people, young and old. And we need to take that seriously and work together to defeat right-wing candidates, to defeat conservative Democrats, and to put progressives in office at every level. And we are not really taking advantage of the opportunity that we have.
Irvashi, I asked Lieutenant Dan Choi how he got to this point, standing, speaking before hundreds of thousands of people. You, too, spoke. How did you get to this point?
Well, I'm an Indian American. I was born in New Delhi, and my family moved here when I was 8 years old. So I've grown up here my whole life. I'm an immigrant, a naturalized U.S. citizen. And my coming out process was very connected to discovering the women's movement, to being part of women's liberation in the 70s, to being part of the anti-apartheid movement, and a lot of social justice activism in the 70s and 80s. And I started working full-time in the LGBT movement in the late 70s and early 80s. So what brings me here is a sense of the interconnection of all of these battles for justice. I feel that, you know, as a woman of color, it's not really separable for me. Racial justice, gay rights, social justice, economic justice, they're intertwined. And the context that we live in requires, I think, the gay movement to see how intertwined our struggle is with the defeat of right-wing values and right-wing ideology. And that's another point that I think is really important for people to remember.
And also your thoughts. Many think that President Obama, you hear this a lot on the networks, he's dealing with healthcare reform, he's dealing with the economy, he's dealing with two wars. They say he can't expend the political capital to reform gay rights in this country. Your thoughts?
I think that's a misreading of the impact of those crises on ordinary people. When people are losing their jobs and they're so insecure and they're so fearful about the future, there is an opening for very, very destructive authoritarian forces to gain in power. And that's what's happening in this country. Who is speaking to those people right now? It's the right wing saying, you have a right to be angry. The government's the problem. This is the problem. Obama's the problem. And I think that it's a mistake to separate these issues from the context, because what's happening is that the immigrants are being blamed, the gays are being blamed, you know, women's equality is being blamed, racial justice is being blamed. And that's where I think Obama is missing the boat. He has to stand up and use his platform and use his moral authority as president to talk about how important it is for people to work together to solve these economic problems. The economy affects everybody, and it's bad. And we need jobs, and we need some real answers. But what he's done is bailed out corporations and banks, and it hasn't really helped ordinary people. So I guess the way I'm trying to answer your question is that I don't see it as, oh, let's solve these problems, and then we'll get to the social issues. I think that social issues are often exploited in times of economic crisis, and we've known that from history all over the world. So we have to really speak to those realities together.
Purvis Uvad, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Attorney, longtime gay rights activist, one of those who addressed the massive crowd in Washington, D.C., executive director of the Arcus Foundation, former head of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Her book is called Virtual Equality, The Mainstreaming of Gay and Lesbian Liberation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're joined by Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Brightsided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. Stay with us.
The second time around, you know it really got me down. Sister, don't you judge it. Just keep it to yourself now. Got nothing good to say. Don't say nothing at all. I got bitten by the bitter bug and I just can't get enough of ill will and my own conceit. I'm weary of the world, it seems. I'm weary of the world. I'm weary of the world. Like I've had hard knocks all my life. Like I'm a Bible Belt wife. Like I didn't see it coming. Like I didn't walk in willingly. See, I never want to sing again. La, 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 like a butterfly. Without my wits about me. Without my heart in line. Third time's a charm. This is mine.
The Indigo Girls here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadouche. Sharif?
Well, October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Pink ribbons are being worn by thousands as walks and events take place across the country to raise awareness about the disease. Well, our next guest opens her new book with a critical analysis of the culture surrounding breast cancer in this country. Barbara Ehrenreich is a journalist and author of 17 books, including the bestsellers Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch. Her latest book, just published, is called Brightsided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America.
Barbara Ehrenreich opens the book by writing about her own experience with breast cancer culture after being diagnosed with breast cancer in 2000. She says, in the prevailing positive thinking culture of America, breast cancer patients are urged to avoid feeling angry, instead find meaning and even uplift in breast cancer. She writes, in the most extreme characterization, breast cancer is not a problem at all, not even an annoyance. It's a gift deserving of the most heartfelt gratitude. Well, in Brightside, cited, Barbara Ehrenreich goes on to document what she says is the destructive power of the positive thinking movement in the United States, from breast cancer to the workplace to the economy to politics as a whole. Barbara Ehrenreich joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have
you with us.
Talk about your experience with breast cancer. Talk about, well, just how you begin the book, Getting Diagnosed.
Okay. This book could be called, you know, What I Learned from Breast Cancer That Helped Me Understand the Financial Meltdown. But I was diagnosed about 8 years ago and started reaching out, as you would do naturally, to find support and information on the web and all that sort of thing. What I found was very different. What I found was constant exhortations to be positive, to be cheerful, to even embrace the disease as if it were a gift. You know, if that's your idea of a gift, take me off your Christmas list, is my feeling. And this puzzled me, but it went along with the idea that you would not get better unless you mobilized all these positive thoughts all the time, which, by the way, I'm happy to tell you, there's nothing to that. There's been sufficient scientific research now that we know that your mood does not, you know, dictate whether you will get better or not. But imagine the burden that is on somebody who's already suffering from a very serious disease. And then, in addition, they have to worry about constantly working on their mood, you know, like a second illness.
So talk about the research. I think that's going to surprise people, what you just said. I mean, you years ago, you were in biology. You were at Rockefeller University.
Oh, yeah. No, here it finally came in useful, that there. I think there's a widespread idea. It sounds so familiar that, you know, you would, you know, just let it go right by you, which is that your immune system will be boosted if you are thinking positively. Well, there's not a whole lot to that. There's not a whole lot to support that. And furthermore, more to the point here, it's not clear that the immune system has anything to do with recovery from cancer or with whether you get it in the first place. Now, I had kind of accepted those things too. But that is the ideology, though, that you find in so many other areas of American life too, that if you can control things with your mind, if you just have the right thoughts and attitudes, there is nothing in the material world that's causing your problem. It's all within you.
And how did this ideology, this positive thinking movement, become so pervasive in American society? You document its rise in the culture.
Yeah, well, I go back to the 19th century because I'm always interested in history. But it really began to take off in a very big way in about the 80s and 90s because the corporate world got very interested in it, got interested in it during the age of downsizing. Because it was a way to say to the person who was losing his or her job, just as you would say to the breast cancer patient, this is in your mind. You know, you can overcome this. If something bad has happened to you, that must mean you have a bad attitude. And now, if you want everything to be all right, just focus your thoughts in this new positive way, and it'll be okay. I can't tell you how many times I have read people who've lost their jobs in this recession in the newspaper saying, but I'm trying so hard to be positive. Well, maybe there's no reason to be positive. Maybe you should be angry, you know? I mean, there is a place for that in the world.
Stepping back for a minute on breast cancer, you make comparisons of breast cancer to prostate cancer and how women are expected to deal. You talk about the pink ribbons, the teddy bears, and how men deal.
Yeah, I had real trouble with the pink teddy bears. That's one of the first things I ran into when at the time of my diagnosis, and is an ad for one of these things, a pink breast cancer teddy bear. Now, that is not how I was feeling. And then the foundation was giving out these sort of nice tote bags to women who came in for treatment in New York City, I think. And I got hold of one of these tote bags, so I wasn't getting treated here. And inside were all these little, you know, cosmetic things and moisturizers and cheap jewelry, and a box of crayons. So I called the foundation. I said, this is really nice, but what's with the crayons? And this woman said to me, well, that's in case you want to write down any of your thoughts. And I said, I'm a writer. I don't use crayons. You know, it was so infantilizing. It's as if, you know, when if a man were to get prostate cancer, we gave him a little matchbook box to call matchbook car to play with. You know, it. I found this very offensive and upsetting.
And what kind of response did you meet with when you went online, went to the listservs?
Well, at that time, when I went online, and I tried going on the Komen Foundation, that's a big breast cancer foundation, message board, and I did a little entry under the subject line, angry. And I talked about health insurance problems I was having. I was talking about what is this disease, very briefly, but what is this disease? How come so many women have it, and we don't know what causes it, and we don't really have a cure? And then I went on to mention, and what's with all the pink ribbons? You know, doesn't sit right with me. And I got back messages from women, also breast cancer sufferers, saying things like, run, don't walk to the nearest therapist. You are not going to get better unless you change your attitude. So I felt very alone. But then I wrote about that experience. I wrote about the whole cancer experience and talked about my disgust at this positive thinking culture that had taken over. And I've gotten wonderful responses. Basically, thank God, someone said it.
Well, some would argue, what's wrong with being optimistic if it helps buoy your spirits? Isn't that harmless in its own right? What would you say to them?
I would say, look at the last year. Look at the financial meltdown, for example. I think, you know, there are many factors in that, you know, greed, all sorts of things. But one of the factors was this very widespread ideology of positive thinking. And it operated at the level of the ordinary person who might want to get a mortgage, for example, and had always been turned down for a mortgage in the past, but who was hearing from his preacher, perhaps, one of his, you know, prosperity gospel preachers, that God wants you to have that big house. And look, the Lord has blessed you with this amazing mortgage. You know, no money down, no proof of income, et cetera. But what was far more significant is what was going on at the other end. And this is, to me, one of the most fascinating things to research, is the change in the corporate culture in the last 15 or so years, as this positive thinking took over and began to replace more logical, analytical approaches to things, focused on the bottom line. And the idea had taken hold that we can do no wrong. Housing prices can never go down. The stock market can never go down. And because I think it's right, you know, it will be right, especially if you're the CEO and you're making $20 million a year. And I think that it became like a mass delusion.
Talk about the economy. A different approach that you think needs to be taken. What does it mean to get angry? Why you actually think that's healthy?
I think, first, I think it would be it's a mistake to try to turn your anger and resentment and sadness or grief into something else. It's very bad to try to just plaster on a smiley face. And that's what Americans have been told to do as they've lost their jobs in layoffs now for a decade. Just put on a smiley face, go to the next place, and, you know. There is a time when you have to say, wait a minute, this is not in me, this is not my attitude, this is coming from somewhere else, and we need to understand what that is and try to figure out how to get together and change it. That's my approach.
You don't think the motivational speakers are going to do it? Talk about your experience at the National Speakers Association.
Oh, yes. I did interview and got a lot of motivational speakers. And these are people who, their primary clients are corporate. They're brought into sales meetings, but also to any kind of general corporate meeting. And the message is again and again, you can have whatever you want so long as you focus your thoughts on it. you know, as long as you really, really, really want it. And I think that's nuts, frankly. I mean, that's not how we make change in the world. You know, we make change by planning, by thinking, and by coming together.
And do you see parallels in the positive thinking movement at the level of political leadership in the country?
Well, Bush, George W. Bush, was certainly the most optimistic president since Reagan. And, you know, that's almost what he saw as his whole role. He'd been a cheerleader in college. He saw what he was doing as a president as a continuation of that, to beam optimism to everybody else. Now, I know Obama talked a lot about hope, and I'd rather hear about a politician's plans than his hopes. But I think he is a very thoughtful person. You know, I think he's not deluded in this way. You know, we have every evidence that he thinks through problems.
And you also helped in 2006. You launched United Professionals, a group.
Yeah.
What does that group do? And talk about right now the middle class in this country, where it's at.
Well, the middle class is in barely, you know, it's just been squeezed so much. It almost doesn't make sense to draw certain lines. So many of people who might have considered themselves middle class have been lining up at food banks or applying for food stamps in the last year. Or, you know, this is another part of my research and reporting, is that it's a disaster losing your health insurance and so on. What they get again and again, whether they're tuning into TV, not your show, but some shows, you know, or so many of these motivational books. A big one in 06 was The Secret, about how you could have anything you wanted by thinking about it. And they're just being pelted with this idea, if I just changed my thoughts, I could have it all. And my alternative to positive thinking is not negative thinking or despair. It's how about realism? Checking out what's really there and figuring out how to change it.
In the midst of this healthcare debate, Barbara Ehrenreich, your thoughts as we wrap up this discussion. You start with breast cancer. You're talking about the relentless promotion of positive thinking. You've long exposed the vested interests in this country.
Well, my thought about health reform is perhaps a little bit out of fashion the way things have been going, but I think that we should have, those of us who are on the progressive side, should have stuck solidly to the single-payer idea and not sort of pre-compromised around the public option, which we seem to have lost anyway, thanks to Democrats. I can't believe it. But better, it seems, to be to stick to your principles, and then if you have to compromise from there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Barbara Ehrenreich has a new book out. It's called Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. She's a frequent contributor to Harper's Magazine, to The Nation, has also been a columnist at The New York Times and Time Magazine. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy or transcript of today's show or see our video podcast or hear our audio podcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Very happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Deguse, Aramate, Angeli Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries, our engineers. Thanks also to Becca Staley, Nick Gill, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jessel Nord, John Gerberg, John Randolph, Kellan Innocent, Kieran Krug Meadows, Vesta Goodars. Again, our website is democracynow.org. You can also go there, follow us on Twitter. You can read the transcripts and pass them on to your friends. The best way to get word out about Democracy Now! Is you talking about it, spreading the word. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharifa Bekaboos. Thanks for joining us.